Welcome to episode 259 of the McSauce Comic Book Podcast. My name is Paul McGinty. With me, as always, are Ian the Sauce Sharpley.
Hello.
And Matt Cassell.
Hello.
It is Monday night, November 12th. And tonight we celebrate the life, the legend, and the legacy of Stan Lee. Earlier today, we learned of the passing of comic book legend Stan Lee, and tonight we celebrate everything he's given to the world. But before we celebrate Stan Lee, we do housekeeping with Ian Sharpley.
Go to McSauce.com. You can find our comic strips. Some of them might be slightly inspired by the works of Stan Lee. You can check out this podcast here that you're listening to. Also, pretty much inspired by a lot of those Marvel comics, great hits that Stan Lee put out there. You can find us on all of your favorite podcast listening devices. You can find us on Podomatic, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, all the good big time hits there. You can have a conversation with us on Facebook. Check us out on Instagram. We also have a YouTube page. And you can find us on Twitter as well. If you're looking for McSauce-inspired gear, check us out on tpublic.com. We actually, this week, we got a review on the hoodies that we have. Lia Sharpley purchased a hoodie and said that they're so comfortable that she's thinking about getting another one.
Fuck. So. Yes.
Thank you, Lia, for...
I thought you were going to say, fuck you. And I was like, for what? She is supporting you.
I know, man. What the fuck?
Get another one. Do it up. I like the...
Hey, that's... Oh, wait, mine's light gray.
How come... You got to send me that so we can blow that out
I am going to put it out there. She just sent it to me over the weekend.
God damn it.
So...
Thanks, Lia. I'm also an owner of that hoodie. Not the same one as your sister, but...
I would hope not.
No, we don't share. We each have our own individual.
That'd be a long... You would have to mail it to New Orleans.
Yeah, but it is. It's very comfortable. And so is my regular McSauce shirt, by the way. I find myself actually just wearing them whenever. I normally would only wear them for conventions and when I'm going to Paul Press the Flesh, but I find myself just wearing them just because they're comfortable. That and, come on, let's be honest, it is... high-end fashion.
Shameless promotion. So thanks to all the McSauce apparel purchasers and...
Looky here, McSauce Nation. We get, our gross from the TeePublic merch is teeny tiny. So I don't say this because I want you to buy more McSauce stuff because we're going to get a big kickback from it. I say it because it's true. All the TeePublic clothing is really comfortable. You can get it in a variety of sizes, styles, softnesses. And aside from t-shirts and hoodies, there's like cell phone cases, stickers, you can get a mug. Like you can get whatever artwork you find of ours on so many different things, and it's relatively cheap. TeePublic always has some like 20% off deal. Like, just because they feel like it. So, go to TeePublic, search for McSauce, M-C-S-O-S-S, and look for some McSauce merch. There's got to be something there that strikes your fancy.
Over the last couple weeks for the election, Lia also went and voted in a McSauce shirt.
Fuck, so, yes.
So, she's been really
Is that all Facebook shit?
No, she's my sister. She sent me fucking text messages.
She needs to put that shit to the McSauce Twitter and Instagram.
I'm going to put it up there.
Come on, Lia.
I'm going to put it up there. She sent it to me to put up. I just haven't put it up.
Don't you want your brother
to
have
success? What are you
waiting for, next year? Yes, that's it. No, I just got the one message the other day. Calm down. Calm the fuck down.
God damn it, Lia. Turn off your podcast listening device right now.
It's not her
We're
fault.
Done here.
She sent it to me.
So why don't we get into Stanley Marvin Lieberman, the godfather of
Martin?
Comic books. Martin?
Mm-hmm.
Martin, not Marvin.
Not Marvin, Martin.
We're off to a great start. I'm off to my regular start, I guess.
Paul, who is Stan Lee? He's the godfather of comics. What did he do?
Stanley co-created pretty much everyone in those Avengers movies that you love.
And anyone else? Anything else? Matt, why don't you take this one? I think you're better at handling this than goofnuts over here.
Stanley, I believe back in the 60s, started creating Marvel superheroes, starting with the creation of the Fantastic Four, which then expanded into characters like Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men, Iron Man, Doctor Strange. That's just off the top of my head.
Did he create the current version of Captain America?
I don't believe so. I don't think that was him. It might have been Jack Kirby, but I'm not sure.
Kirby was on that book, and they came out in during World War II.
Yeah.
He went away for a while and came back in the 60s, and I believe that Stanley was instrumental in revitalizing it, but he doesn't take credit for creating that character.
It's funny. Jack Kirby was going to be, I think, one of the artists that worked on Spider-Man on creating him. But from what I understand, Stan Lee specifically did not want Jack Kirby to draw Spider-Man because he needed him to be kind of creepy looking, a little wiry, sort of different. And therefore,
Jack Kirby could only draw one thing, bulky with thick lines.
Right. So he just didn't fit that vision.
He didn't want Spider-Man to be too handsome and dapper. Right. And that's kind of Jack Kirby's thing.
Ironically, the co-creator of Spider-Man, Steve Ditko, always felt like Stan Lee took a little too much credit for the creation of Spider-Man. Stan created the idea of Spider-Man and, you know, talked about him being a teenager with spider powers and all that stuff. But as far as the look, that was Steve Ditko.
Because Stan Lee kind of had, it goes sort of part and parcel with the Marvel method, the way, the groundbreaking way that comics were created through Marvel, and it allowed Stan Lee to sort of put a lot of ideas out there, but also give the artists a lot of
He never had to fully realize his ideas. I mean, it really was collaboration in the truest sense, although I do think that he was kind of off the hook a little bit when it came to really having to do the heavy lifting. Maybe he did come up with the initial ideas, but it does seem like the artists a lot of the time probably put in the bulk of the work.
I think where Stan Lee shined brightest was being the ultimate hype man and ultimate pitch
Absolutely.
Man and ultimate salesman
yep.
of those ideas, and the hard work that those artists did with creating and realizing those worlds. I think we can all agree that as artists, sometimes we aren't the best supporters or promoters of our own work. Stan Lee always was the person that pushed forward how great the Marvel Universe was and why it was something that kids needed to be wrapped up in.
But aside from being the ultimate hype man, he was also putting the words in these characters' mouths and developing, you know, these personalities. And like who these characters would become for generations, because you can have any writer you want on Spider-Man for the last, I don't know how many years. I can't do math. A lot of years. A
lot of years. Bunches of years.
But Peter Parker's still Peter Parker in it.
Or is he?
Well, I think every writer that's come on that book, no matter how we feel about those writers, they write Peter Parker based on their interpretation of what they learned from Stan Lee. So even if we don't like what Dan Slott was doing, Dan Slott is writing his best Stan Lee Peter Parker, because that's who that character is. That character is the child of Stan Lee and Steve Ditko.
Okay.
You don't think current writers just eschew what Stan did and I'm doing my own thing now. Fuck Stan Lee.
Yeah, pretty much. That's kind of the way I see it. I mean, look at Brian Michael Bendis. His Stan Lee's Spider-Man wasn't even good enough to make Peter Parker. He had to create a completely different character that wasn't Stan Lee's creation.
Yeah, but I mean, Bendis does everything based on what his kids want. I mean, there's a new Wonder Comics book coming out called Naomi, based on a black girl orphan, which is his daughter, pretty much.
His daughter's a black girl orphan?
Yeah, him and his wife have adopted three kids, I think. One of them's black, one of them's Asian. But yeah, this book, Naomi, it's just, hey, what do you want, daughter? And this is what he's doing.
Miles Morales was created years ago, though. That might have been before.
Right, but it also has to do with, you know.
I don't think that it has anything to do with Bendis's burning desire to piss all over the legacy of Stan Lee.
Yeah, Bendis does what Bendis wants. It has nothing to do with fuck Stan Lee.
Well, I'm just saying, Paul, you were saying that everybody's doing their best version of.
You don't think Bendis's Peter Parker in Ultimate Spider-Man was a updated version of Stan Lee's
Peter Parker? Obviously it was, but I'm just saying, like.
Well, then we agree. Okay. Next topic.
All right, next topic.
I don't have a next one. One of you guys help me out.
I think we're going to stay on this whole Stan Lee thing for a minute. Ian, I wanted to ask you, when did you become aware of Stan Lee?
Probably before I was a comic book fan, honestly. And I think that harkens back to his great salesmanship and his pervasiveness in the pop culture. I think we all know Stan Lee's voice. We can hear it.
Yeah.
We know everybody that hears my voice right now knows exactly what Stan Lee sounds like from a cartoon or a voiceover or Mallrats, whatever. Stan Lee was, I knew of Stan Lee from the Spider-Man cartoon the 60s Spider-Man cartoon whenever I was really young, and then also Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
That's where I knew him from.
Yeah, he gave that voice,
and it was so iconic. I want to say it was the most iconic thing about the guy.
Was his voice,
yeah.
Kind of,
and, like, the way that he spoke, and it was very Carnival Barker-esque.
It was, but it was always so positive. I feel like that's a takeaway that is really important that I don't want to not give credit to tonight, is I feel like Stan Lee's positivity was somewhat infectious. I really appreciate the simpler time in which he was writing comic books. And, you know, while he certainly tackled social issues of the day, I still think that he was able to do it in a more, I guess, lighthearted way. Without completely like sidestepping that kind of stuff. And he always had a kind of a whimsical nature to like his salesmanship, showmanship at Marvel, particularly with his column Stan Soapbox. Do you remember reading those?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't remember reading those. I know what they are because I saw a lot of them referenced today.
And there's some heavy stuff in there. There's a lot of stuff racism, and we have to remember that Marvel Comics came up to being part of the zeitgeist in the 60s whenever there was a lot of strife in the country, and he was speaking to children and trying to be as serious as he could about serious topics, and Stan Lee was instrumental in maybe bending the comics code a little bit with some of the stuff that they addressed in those comic books.
I really liked his approach, though. It was always on the more positive side of things. You know, he promoted, I mean, even in one of his last Twitter posts, that video that he put out there was all about like loving each other and not being, hateful or anything like that. And it's just like such a good message to live by. And I think we'd all do well to kind of heed his words long after he's gone, because if we can, like, holy shit, I think this world would be a really good place. You know, he was almost like the Mr. Rogers of the comic book world.
Matt, I want to jump back to a little bit ago when you said one of his most iconic features was his voice.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned to you guys right before we started recording, John Suntress of at John Word Balloon on Twitter. He posted a video from 1968, which it's a video with Stan Lee and one of the other old Marvel guys is on it. I forget who it is. But Stan Lee is unrecognizable in this video. He's got a beard, a pretty full head of hair. All of it's dark. He's not graying yet. No glasses, no tinted glasses. He doesn't look like that classic Stan Lee image we all picture. And whenever the video, before he starts speaking, when the video starts, I'm watching it today. I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? But as soon as he opens his mouth, it is 100% Stan Lee. Like that voice is so iconic. And I think it is the most iconic part of who he is, because that's the voice that's delivering that message. Like all of the positivity. Like, I don't know that Stan Lee ever delivered anything but positivity. Maybe Steve Ditko has a different story. maybe Jack Kirby has a different story, but Stan Lee is one of those guys that he's always been one of the absolute best people on the planet. There was some questionable topics that came up through his last few months about him harassing a couple like hospice nurses or something. But like, as far as I'm concerned, like Stan Lee can be put up there with Mr. Rogers. Like, I don't think he really, well, I mean, Mr. Rogers never posed for Playgirl, I guess, but he's been such a bastion of positivity that I can't separate all of the goodness that Stan Lee put into the world from the person that he is. Like, he'll always be such a bastion of positivity for me. And that voice just always delivers positivity. Even when it comes to talking about the things Dick and Mallrats, it is a positive story about the things Dick.
Yeah, I really like that cameo that he has. I mean, you know, of all the cameos that he's ever had in a Marvel movie, the one that he had in Mallrats is the best. It's just so freaking good. And for him to be given such a generous amount of screen time to be himself.
He really delivers.
He really does. The only,
he's like a quintessential showman. Even if it is a small cameo, which he's kind of known for at this point to a generation of people, he always, it's a cameo, he sticks out, but in that Mallrats, it goes to the heart of, he always wants to deliver something that's memorable.
You can be a quintessential showman and be a bad actor, and I don't think Stan Lee is going to be held up with Laurence Olivier or anything, but
our greatest actor.
But, my first experience of Stan Lee was in Mallrats. I didn't even really know who he was in Mallrats.
That's because you were like, all I like is hockey and baseball cards, motherfucker.
I knew who he was in Mallrats based on what Mallrats told me up until that point. So the first time I'm watching the scene in Mallrats when Brody's like,
They do his character, hey, his bio.
You created all these characters. What were you thinking? And like Stan Lee's delivering the, I created all these characters based on all of my insecurities. And I was like, oh man, like this is a like really great story for Brody to learn from this fake comic book creator that Kevin Smith created for this movie.
Wow, you're a wild piece of shit that you didn't know who Stan Lee was.
And then there's the twist at the end where he's like, yeah, I just told him not to, you know, shut him up. And then only after I saw Mallrats was I like, oh, Stan Lee is the real, he's the real guy. Like, that wasn't a bit, that wasn't a character. Like, it was a bit, but like, that was the guy, that was the real guy, because like, I mean, you guys know, I didn't get into comics until much later. So
it was 10 years later. Yeah, after
Mallrats was 1996. That would have made Stan...
Was Mallrats 96? So it was that late, huh?
Pretty sure.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick look.
Maybe 95?
You're pretty sure?
Yeah, it might be 95. It's probably 95, actually.
Yeah, I'm
1995, so I probably didn't get into it until 97 with the VHS / HBO release schedule, because the first time I saw it was on HBO, so that had to be at least 97. So I didn't get into comics until
2001.
That would have made him 72 years old. That's how long ago it was.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He had the full beard in it. I think he still was rocking the hair plugs at that point. But he looked good. He was real spry.
He was great in that role. You know, when he delivers the story about, you know, the Hulk and how like he didn't see himself as being able to, you know, get the girl and everything, like I felt it. Mallrats is not a movie that should evoke emotion, but like for me it did. For me it still does. I still love Mallrats, and I think Stan Lee did exactly, he gave more than what that movie called for, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Kevin Smith said at the time, that movie, when he was making it, that particular scene was like his version of George Lucas's American Graffiti when, what character is it? Ron Howard's character, whenever he meets Wolfman, the radio DJ, and he meets him and the ice cream was melting and he's eating those popsicles that were melting. You remember that?
Nope.
I've only seen American Graffiti once.
American Graffiti is
I know you so like good. It a lot.
But that was the inspiration. That scene in American Graffiti was the inspiration for Stan Lee's cameo in Mallrats, which again is the best cameo that Stan Lee has ever had.
Cuz it's not just, I mean, I guess it counts as a cameo, but it's beefy. He's got lines. Yeah, right. Like he's got,
yeah.
He develops himself as a character in that universe. It's not just, you know, the ticket taker or the mailman.
Right, right, right.
Or the DJ in Deadpool. Like he's a legitimate guy in that movie.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of cameos, this is really off subject, but we were just talking about George Lucas with American Graffiti. George Lucas has a cameo in a movie. Do you know what it is? I may have told you before. It's like really weird. It's really fucking random.
Is it Battlefield Earth?
No. Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Really?
Yeah. George Lucas is in line to get on one of the rides in the amusement park.
Is Eddie
park.
Murphy even in Beverly
and
Hills
Eddie
Cop
Murphy
3?
Cuts in front of him in yeah. line, and George Lucas yells, hey! I swear hey. To God, it's in there.
Hey.
But anyway.
Hey.
That's pretty weird. How yeah. do you? Why do you know that?
Why? Because come on, Ian.
I was watching it.
I need to hear it from him.
I was watching Beverly Hills Cop 3, as you do, and suddenly George Lucas is in Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Is
and
it
you know
a
what
prominent
I said?
Thing where they like really focus on like, hey, everybody.
I don't know. I think we should put it on the McSauce Facebook page so that way everyone can see and
they can
judge
for
themselves.
And we will also be sued for copyright.
And when it happened in the movie, I said, hey, just like George Lucas said.
Very cool. I like it.
Yeah.
So Matt, besides Spider-Man, what's your favorite Stan Lee creation? Do you have a Do you have a second, a third, perhaps?
Well, I do think that the X-Men, while I've never really been able to get into the X-Men, I love them in the sense that I like that they exist. I think
you don't like angsty teen soap operas?
I think, you know, the old saying, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I disagree when it comes to the X-Men. I find all the parts individually to be a lot more interesting than them as a collective team. But I like the idea of it and what it represents, you know, like that the whole race thing and, you know, the comparisons to Professor X is Martin Luther King and Magneto was Malcolm X. And I'm fascinated by that inspiration for these characters. I love the way that they've been represented in other things that I feel like have been a little bit more accessible to me than the comics. Although I do think that the Ultimate X-Men was pretty accessible when it first started. I was kind of thinking I'd like to go back and revisit that because I just like the idea of it. Mm-hmm. But I just, for whatever reason, actually reading it never resonated with me.
Because the main writer of the X-Men, Chris Claremont, wrote it for 30 plus years or mm-hmm. however long, and he knew that he essentially had control of that world and that job for as long as he wanted to. So he would embed a lot of crazy little side plots and different things that wouldn't pay off for years and years and years. Sometimes that's a really high bar to clear as a new reader,
right,
or somebody that wants to get invested with it. I agree with you, Matt, though. A lot of the ways that the X-Men parallel a lot of things in current society are probably the thing that always drew me to the X-Men. I like all the you know, the drama and of the team, and I like the characters. I think they're all very vibrant characters, and I think that they do work well together.
Mm-hmm.
As a team. They were probably the X-Men in the early 90s was probably my favorite comic book series to get invested.
Well, you had the cartoon show as well, which was very accessible.
Yeah.
And
a lot of people, even outside of our realm of comic book fans, a lot of people know of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
They could tell you stuff. Oh, I know about the Phoenix Saga, or, oh, mm-hmm. I know who Omega Red is, or
right,
all those weird things simply based on the comics. So that
I was not reading comics in the early 90s, but
no. Did you watch the cartoon?
Yeah. Like I knew who all those dudes were.
Yeah.
And it was at the point where when I started reading X-Men comics that I was like, wait a second. Like, why does this character look different? Who's this guy? Because, like, when I picked that stuff up, I wanted the stuff from the cartoon.
But it was all the Grant Morrison, like, right after the reboot. It's the new X-Men stuff,
right. Black leather suits.
Stripped down all of that 90s excess and really got it back to the weird core of the X-Men, I guess. Like, back at the school teaching.
You know, I feel like the X-Men hadn't really broken through into pop culture until that cartoon show. They were much lesser known. Like, as a kid growing up, my favorite Stan Lee creations were obviously Spider-Man number one, and The Incredible Hulk was probably a close number two. And to this day, I love The Incredible Hulk.
Did you like the old 70s Hulk TV show?
I liked... Not really. Like, I liked that it was there. I was too young, I think, to really be able to follow it. I liked much more the Batman 60s TV show. I felt like for a kindergartner, that I could keep up with. The Lou Ferrigno TV show, I don't think that my little, like, five-year-old brain could kind of keep up
with. The sadness of traveling the world.
Yeah.
I was all in on The Incredible Hulk. I love that
show.
You
were in your 20s whenever that came out, so I would imagine that you could relate.
It's funny. We got jokes on the McSauce podcast. The big jokes. Yeah,
that made you store, dude.
Yeah, I was all in the Incredible Hulk. I didn't think it was something that was inaccessible to me. Certainly, I didn't understand the lonely man theme. Do I understand?
Do you now, right, boy?
But yeah, I mean, like back then, it was just, you know, a guy that turned into a monster, and like that was enough. Mm-hmm. Not only, you know, the older I got, I understand, you know, the nuance that, like, man, every time this guy wakes up in the morning, he's mad because he wishes he was dead.
The perfect hero for a modern day Paul McGinty.
The Incredible Hulk was so good. The, you know, the Thor episodes, maybe not so much.
No,
but that Bill Bixby, you know, David Banner version of the Hulk, you know, like the Hulk at his core. I think that's when he's absolutely at his best. And, you know, maybe...
Do you know why they changed the name from Bruce Banner to David Banner?
Because the studio or whoever, ABC or CBS or whoever was running it, thought Bruce Banner was too alliterative. It sounded too comic booky.
That's not what I heard either, Matt. Go ahead, because I think we're on the same page.
I thought that they said that the name Bruce was too soft. It didn't... That's not what you heard either.
That I did, but they did not use the word soft.
Oh.
They used the word faggot.
Woof. They didn't use that one either. They just said gay, but you know.
Hey, this was 1977.
Not everybody was woke back then. Nope. David's more like non-homosexual.
Dave. You got a big hard D at the beginning of that name.
So
the 70s. What are we gonna do with them?
Ian, you want to put your B in someone?
Have you read anything by Stanley? That's kind of a stupid question, but
I've read Amazing Fantasy 15.
Yeah,
I've read some of the old, like I have Marvel Unlimited, so I've read a lot of the older Ditko Stanley stuff from.
Yeah,
the original run. I mean, it's really tough. I have a tough time going back in time with a lot of media, with movies. It's hard for me to go back in time with books. So those are rough reads because they're all really wordy in comparison to what we know as comic books today.
Yeah, yeah, I get that, but at the same time, I enjoy going into that like time capsule a little bit.
Yeah, I don't hate them, but it's tough. You know,
well, you know, here's the thing. I really like the simplicity of the way that Spider-Man was back then, and that's a large reason why I prefer the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies, because I feel like they harken to that era of Spider-Man very strongly. And not only that, but I actually lost my train of thought.
You like the more simplistic storytelling of Spider-Man?
Well, I do. Yeah.
You liked it when Spider-Man was great.
Make Spider-Man great again.
See, I didn't want you to say that slogan because that kind of tarnishes it.
But you like the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies.
I did, because I felt like he was using the original Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, John Romita Sr. era of Spider-Man as his template. And not only is it my favorite of all the Spider-Mans, but it's my favorite superhero movie ever. Like,
those aren't your favorite Spider-Man comics. So it's weird to me that you would connect to those movies based on the Stan Lee versions, but your wheelhouse for Spider-Man is
a more
McFarlane
evolved one.
It's like a McFarlane, slightly more evolved. It's not
Eric
like
Larson stuff.
Go back and read that. It's not that much more evolved from the Stan Lee stuff. Like where it is today, I think is way more different then
I think it's definitely a couple steps further.
Well, okay, so I think the Larson McFarlane stuff, let's put that in the middle, right? And the Stan Lee stuff's at the one end of the spectrum.
Okay.
And today's version is at the other end. I think the McFarlane Larson stuff is definitely closer to the Stan Lee stuff than the modern version of Spider-Man that we have today.
I would agree with that. It's the modern stuff is overly complicated.
I take exception to modern stuff. I know when you guys say modern stuff, you're talking, you know, the last 10 years mm-hmm. of Spider-Man. But the absolute current Amazing Spider-Man run, the Nick Spencer run with Ryan Otley and Umberto Ramos on
right,
the book.
You're talking
right
about now, 6 issues, dude.
Right. I am talking about 6 issues, but it is more what Matt's talking about. It is simplistic Spider-Man.
I need to get in there.
There's some modern nuances of it. It's in the current Marvel universe for mm-hmm. sure, but the way Peter's character is handled, the way Mary Jane's handled, their relationship, the way they're both kind of down on their luck, just struggling to find like that next step for their life, their careers. It feels like it's the most classic Spider-Man story we've gotten since maybe the McFarlane Larson stuff.
And that's fair. And I'm sure it is. But we're talking about a sample size that's extremely small compared to...
Even the guy that followed them with a pretty significant run, Howard Mackey, wrote it. I feel like that was in the vein more so of the McFarlane Larson, David Michelini or whatever the hell his name was.
Michelini.
Yeah. And you never really liked any of the JMS.
No. I liked it initially, but I feel like he had one story to tell, and then he didn't know what he was doing after that.
Well, how many steps away from the Lee stuff would you say the McFarlane stuff was?
A few.
If Stan Lee's a number one, Dan Slott's a 20.
I think that Where's McFarlane fall? I think the
7 or 8.
Like, the McFarlane stuff.
Right in the middle? That far away?
It's close. Yeah, it's closer to the middle. I mean, but it's still closer to the Stan Lee stuff. I think, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as intimate with the McFarlane stuff as you guys are. I thought you would have put that number a little bit lower. No. Like, I'd put the Nick Spencer stuff at, like, a 4.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
about
like,
that. I mean,
but
I
like,
one,
but the JMS stuff, which I love, is probably like a 15, just because it's, you know, here's like Stan Lee writing Spider-Man as an adolescent, and here's JMS writing him as an adult. But it's such
age,
a natural progression,
really, right? Yeah, like age doesn't matter
where that character would be. Right, it's still the same. It is. Oh my God, I fucking love that JMS stuff. I beat my dick to that JMS stuff. It's so good.
Like the fact that JMS saw it fit to take him back to high school and have him become a teacher, I think, while age-wise, sure, his progression is further down the road, I think that still harkens back and is close to the roots of that nerdy teenager that Stan Lee created all those years ago. I think that that's very similar to the stresses and problems that the original version of Spider-Man had.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's why
right.
I would say it's not so far away.
You're right.
If we're getting into like Clone Saga shit, then that's I feel like that's way further away than any of the JMS stuff.
I am totally off on that number. The JMS stuff is classic. I'd give it a 2.
15 to 2.
It's so good.
Hey, such a swing. It's a sharply swing right there.
Wow.
I am.
Sharply Spider-Man swing. All that alliteration.
To admit my faults and wrongdoings.
Get the fuck out of here. Okay.
That's what I just did, asshole.
So, okay.
I think the classic story that Stan Lee ever wrote, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's the death of Gwen Stacy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most famous of all the Stan Lee stories. That one had it resonated for years and years. It had lasting,
it wasn't long like lasting Inhumans 20
ramifications. What?
It wasn't like Inhumans number 20.
Did he write that?
I have no idea. Fuck the Inhumans. They're dumb characters.
Such a hater.
Don't even know why that was brought up, but okay.
He was just going for a random issue of a not well-liked
comic book that had nothing to do with Stan Lee.
Did he not write Inhumans?
I don't know. Look it up. Did he fucking write Inhumans number 20?
I don't know. Let's take a look.
Well, while we're looking that up,
yeah, Matt you had a point. Talking?
Well, my point was just that I would say that the pinnacle, the penultimate Stan Lee story that was ever written was The Death of Gwen Stacy, which I did read.
The penultimate. So you have an ultimate story.
I would say, yeah, it's that. It's The Death of Gwen Stacy.
I know. It's going to be grammar pod here. Isn't penultimate the step before the ultimate? Yeah. Like the step before the top? So.
Oh.
So like Empire Strikes Back is the penultimate chapter of the original trilogy.
Right. Like.
What?
It's one step before the top.
Oh, then your analogy isn't right, Paul. Right?
Semantics.
No, it's completely right. Penultimate is the chapter before the end.
Oh, before the end.
I said the original trilogy.
Like the Empire is done, Darth Vader's dead, Luke's a Jedi. That's the ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The penultimate is.
I thought you were like saying it as if you were ranking it. Like it's the penultimate.
Right? I don't have publication dates or issue numbers, but. The Inhumans were created by Stan Lee.
But penultimate
and Jack Kirby.
Heart, like hints that you were going to have another one.
No, I
above.
Just clearly don't know how to use words.
the McSauce Grammar Pod is here to help everybody out.
Which shouldn't be a surprise here on the McSauce Comic Book Podcast. We're only 259 episodes in. Shame on you if you didn't know that I don't know words. So I'm sorry. The ultimate issue or storyline that Stan Lee ever wrote was the. Death of Gwen Stacy. It's really sad that those ramifications kind of were not permanent. Even though they were long-lasting, they weren't permanent. And that's kind of a bummer because...
Well, nothing's permanent in comic books, you know.
But
that.
It was for so long. Like
Bucky was dead for 50 years.
Huh?
I said Bucky was dead for 50 years and then
yeah,
he wasn't.
But there was never an intention to bring that character back or George Stacy back.
So, but Gwen, for the longest time, Gwen Stacy, Bucky, Jason Todd.
Those were your go-tos.
Uncle Ben.
He's not walking through that door.
Right. I mean, up until a handful of years ago, those were legitimate untouchable deaths in comics. And Stanley wrote one of them.
Right. I agree. I'm just saying.
Two of them, technically. Uncle Ben.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, and actually, Spider-Man had a lot of deaths around, you know, there were a lot of deaths around that character that lasted.
They should have called him the Black Widow.
Yeah, seriously. Like, you had George Stacy, you had Uncle Ben, you had Gwen Stacy.
His parents, even before
right.
we knew who Peter Parker was, his parents were already dead.
Yep.
I think it still has long-lasting effects on the way that a lot of writers write Spider-Man and the way that there is that responsibility of his uncle dying and the fact that he couldn't save Gwen Stacy. A lot of writers choose to ignore some of that retconning of bringing her back or whatever the fuck happened with
right,
her.
Because Gwen Stacy is a much more valuable character dead
than alive.
Well,
right?
She really is.
She's still dead in the real Marvel Universe.
Oh, excuse me, the real Marvel Universe.
Who knows?
Well,
I don't know.
Like you make jokes, but that's how we need to distinguish the 616. It's the real Marvel Universe.
Didn't they bring her back in the 616?
What's Gwenpool or whatever?
That's some
Spider Gwen.
She's from like another dimension.
But okay. didn't JMS bring her back?
Yeah, in that Mike Deodato run.
Yeah. So, but like most writers,
but I don't. I think at some point that was retconned back out. Because she's not around now. And so, I don't think she's been around even through the entire Dan Slott run. I think she was probably out from Brand New Day.
My point is that most writers pick and choose what they incorporate into the canon, and most writers decide to write that event as a event that changed Peter Parker's life and altered it, and it's the sadness of not being that hero in that moment and couldn't save my own girlfriend. Like, they choose to select that and keep that in his psyche. So I think that's as long-lasting as something that can be in comic books. Stan Lee writing that issue of Spider-Man and that event has lasted the test of time.
Okay, that's cool. And
I mean, I...
No, seriously, I'm happy about that. Maybe I was mistaken, because I see characters like Spider-Gwen, and I'm like, why yeah. are you doing this?
Yeah, that's all dumb. It's just I think it's just trying to reach for different things or pull characters and twist them in different ways. Can we just create new characters? Can't we do that?
We've been begging for it for years. Yeah. That's nothing new. Nobody seems to be able to do that since the 90s.
I mean, it's a testament to Stan the Man and all he could create, all these long-lasting characters that were so great that we need to dig them up out of their graves and repurpose them. Mm-hmm.
I think the only actual Stan Lee story I read was the initial Spider-Man story.
Yeah.
Amazing Fantasy 15.
I don't even think it was that. I think it was the first six issues of Spider-Man number one.
Really? When would you have the first wait, time out. The first six issues of Spider-Man number one?
I don't know what, because Amazing Fantasy isn't the first is that the first?
It's the first appearance of Spider-Man.
But is that the story where
yes.
he gets his powers and he does the wrestling and then Uncle Ben dies and
yes.
all that?
Yes.
So I guess I must have that upstairs.
Okay.
The first issue, six issues.
Yeah, that was just one issue.
Fantasy 15.
Stop.
You
it.
Guys can make Stop fun it. Of me all you want.
I'm only laughing because he's making me.
That's fine. You guys can make fun of me all you want. I'm not pretending that I know more than I do. There's some fucking Stanley trade paperback written up there, some reprint. I don't know what the fucking original issue
Dickhead,
numbers
I'm
are.
Just making fun of the fact that you said the first six issues of issue number one.
Well,
that's all I'm making fun of. Like,
oh, okay. Semantics. Yes, McSauce that's grammar. What I'm McSauce making fun grammar of. Grammar pot, everyone.
Fuck. I've become the thing that I hate.
Yeah, you were always the one that was pointing out.
Well, see, like, we do that. But what my point is, I thought they introduced Spider-Man in Amazing Fantasy 15.
Yeah.
And then, like, oh, everyone really liked this character. Now we're going to do Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man number one.
That's totally what happened.
So I don't know.
But they, packed his origin in Amazing Fantasy 15.
Right. So I don't know what collected issues I have, but
yeah,
I'm
not busting your balls.
I have
about
the origin
that.
Story, and I think the last page of the trade is like, something's up with Harry. And we don't know
he's
what's
on
up with Harry.
Fucking heroin right. or whatever the fuck.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm not busting your
nonsense.
Balls about that, man. It's just bullshit.
But like, I haven't read that in years. But when I read it, I didn't have a problem with the writing. I didn't think the writing was super outdated or, you know, from the 60s. It's the art that I have the most problem with, and I've had this problem with all kinds of artwork.
I thought you were okay with like weird or outdated artwork, but not writing. I thought you were okay with that.
I have a really hard time looking at old artwork because I can't focus away from it.
Yeah.
With the writing, I can look at it and be like, okay, you know, it was like from a different time, but with the artwork, I'm like, why didn't they do this? Why couldn't they do this? Like, why does this look like this?
Because they were smoking 1,000 cigarettes and getting paid 15 cents a page.
Yeah, I have a hard time separating myself more from the artwork.
Yeah.
But there's a very good chance we end this podcast, I go upstairs, and I read that now, and I'm like, oh no, the artwork's fine. The writing's trash city. But like, regardless, I have such a hard time going back and reading old art, even stuff from the 80s, like the John Byrne Man of Steel stuff, which is touted as, you know, the pinnacle of
you
Superman
hate
books.
George Perez, don't you? You don't like his aesthetic.
George Perez's art looks 80s as fuck, but I get it. Like, I can go back and read those new Teen Titans books and be like, all right, you know, I know clearly when this takes place. I have a problem with Jack Kirby's artwork.
Yeah.
Like, that shit looks so fucking dated to me. Like, I just can't get around it. I think just old comics in general, I have a hard time reading. And I had less of a gradual introduction into comics. Not that comics from the early 90s look a lot like what they do now, but they were much more akin to comics from the 80s and the 70s than, you know, Batman Hush, which was, you know, the first single issue that I picked up. So going back and reading those old 80s and especially like 70s and 60s books, and I have, you know, Son of the Demon, like I have a ton of old, you know, Denny O'Neill Green Lantern stuff upstairs, and I read it and I'm just like, oh my god, this is so old. Like, I can feel my life force draining out of me when I read these books. It just doesn't get it done for
me. I have
me.
A completely different reaction. I love that old stuff. I just love immersing myself in that poppier style artwork. It's more simplistic. It's bigger, bolder, more like kind of colorful.
Because it's all flat.
Yeah,
it's
all flat color. I just think it's so fucking dynamic the way that it's just so. It's just very graphic, you know, and I feel like as I've evolved as an artist over the years, I've really kind of adopted, I think, a lot of those kind of sensibilities and ideas behind my art. So I really have an appreciation for it. I wanted to share kind of a crappy story. It's not that exciting, but I met Stan Lee once, and it probably does not rank as one of my awkward brushes with fame. It's pretty legit. He was at the Pittsburgh Comic Con, or maybe it was the Steel City Comic Con, maybe about 8 years ago, and I decided I was going to wait in line, but it was one of those things where you basically buy a ticket and then you have to like go back during a certain time, you know, like a window, mm-hmm. and then the line is much, much smaller. It's very manageable doing it that way. So, I didn't really have anything for him to sign. Like, I don't own a whole lot of original stuff that he's ever, you know, worked on. It's all collected or, you know, digital. Maybe not at the time, but whatever. And I was like, it'd be kind of lame to get a trade paperback reprinted thing signed by him. So I was looking around the convention, and I came across one of those really cool Treasury editions. They were like those oversized comics, and it was the Treasury edition for the Spectacular Spider-Man number one. So it's got John Romita Sr. artwork right there on the cover. It's gorgeous. It was like $25, and I was like, this will be perfect for him to sign. So I bought it, and then I went up to him, and he had his handler, his assistant, very, very attractive young Asian lady.
Whoa. Right up Matt's alley.
Yeah, and and I made my way to him. And I'm thinking, like, as I'm getting closer, I was starting to get starstruck. I was starting to, you know, I'm getting into that territory where something stupid is about to happen involving me, because I get really stupid around celebrities, apparently. And I'm thinking, like, what can I say to Stan Lee that doesn't come off as a blathering fanboy, just dweeb? Something that he gets, like, on a minute-by-minute basis in his life. I didn't want to just be the next idiot in the next minute of Stan Lee's life.
You wanted to be profound.
I wanted what I said to stick with him, and I'm sure it did, for the rest of his life. For his remaining 8 years.
All up until today.
I'm sure it was the last thing he thought of when he died. Maybe not. So I'm making my way to him, and
his
and
last thoughts were, "So handsome."
Well, he wouldn't be wrong there.
You are pretty handsome.
Yeah, right.
Good
so
looking guy.
I got my picture taken with him, actually.
Sort of.
Yeah, I was maybe about 30 feet in front of him, and he was in the background.
Or 50 feet.
50 feet.
In another room.
Yeah, but my picture has him in it, so therefore it's a picture with Stan Lee. And, but anyway, so as I'm making my way to him, he looks at his handler. Is that the right word?
Sure.
His yeah. assistant. And he says, "I don't know, is he worthy? Do you think he's worthy?" He said that about me. He wasn't fucking...
Because he knew your fucking dorky he ass see- was going to come in his pants.
Wait, what?
You knew... He knew that you were going to come whenever he said that to
you. I think Ian was clear. Your dorky ass was going to shoot a load
into Stan Lee's pants. He knew it.
I didn't think there was any question about that statement.
What was unclear about the way I said that?
I didn't know that...
He knew you were going to come in his pants.
Was I going to put them on? Hey, Stan, can I borrow those? That's what I said to him. I was like, hey, I'm sure you always get like these fanboys that are like, oh my God, I love Spider-Man. But I'm like, no, give me your pants. I have to come in them.
Now, this was going to be like some like temporal warp hole thing where you were going to come and it would just be in Stan's pants.
He was like, Excelsior.
So he says to his assistant, I don't know, is he worthy? And I didn't know what to say. I wasn't prepared for him to kind of give me some shit. So I think I just stood there like a dork until he was like, yeah, I think he's worthy. So I put my book down and he signed it and I got to shake his hand and I just said, you know, it's nice to meet you and thank you for everything. And that was all I could think of to say. I was kind of proud that I didn't gush all over the place or in his pants, I guess. But I was still happy that I was able to kind of keep it together a little bit. But I do think that kind of summed it up, because in reality, Stan Lee, we just talked about it recently on one of our podcasts. He's one of the three pillars. Matt's personal pillars.
That would work so MPP much better if it was Paul's personal pillars, because alliteration is king.
Right. Unfortunately, you hate Stan Lee, so it won't work for you.
I'm indifferent.
But he is one of the three pillars creators.
Matt's masterful mastodons.
Matt's major moments.
But George Lucas and John Williams, I put as this like trifecta of people that I feel like have defined the way that I sort of perceive entertainment, pop culture. And so just saying thank you was really all I could say, because anything else would have come across as like unbearably obnoxious, I think. Similar to, you know how, like, when somebody comes in your pants, how obnoxious that is?
I hate it.
It really is.
I don't even get the enjoyment of semen filled underwear.
It's well, you
you
it's,
do.
It's surprising,
but it's not. You didn't put it there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So, the enjoyment comes from putting it there, not having it there.
Right. You get the shame and like,
you get the shame.
Wonder.
You get the shame and the stain.
No one would jerk off if all of a sudden you had the shame and the stain.
But you would do it more if you could distribute the shame and the
it's
stain.
It's the distribution. It's the act that makes it happen.
Would you have the shame if you could outsource the stain?
No, I don't think you would. You would have the pride.
You would have the pride and the clean.
Boom, Ian, good luck with that. I'm not shameful at all. I just came in your pants.
That would be amazing. That I feel like that is a missing opportunity for Stan Lee to create an X-Men
who could
distribute cum stains.
What an insult to the cum E. If all of a sudden you were like, fuck, man, did you just come in my pants?
No, but yeah.
No, you'd say yes because you'd have no shame attached to it.
I like, think it would be shame.
I came if in we your
could,
pants.
If we could teleport cum to each other, I think there would be a little bit of shame. There would be some weirdness.
Do you know how much...
Some weirdness.
Do you
what
know
the fuck are we talking
how
about?
Much more I would jerk off if I could just put the cleanup somewhere else?
Who's a mutant that teleports? Like, we are...
Nightcrawler.
Appropriate. I don't even have to change the name.
Right.
Nightcrawler.
Nightcrawler.
You. Ah. Have
we're
fun
just,
with that.
We're just bamfing in each other's bamf.
Bamf. Oh no.
Man, this Stan Lee retrospective really got off the rails. Oh, come on. Don't act like Stan Lee never fucking beat his dick.
I wasn't. That's not what I was doing.
Did any of us indicate that we thought that he's never masturbated?
Someone out there in McSauce Nation. Someone
right.
out there
you just
thinks,
had to set the record straight.
Someone
we're
out there.
Not, well, McSauce is here to say that Stan Lee jerked off. All right? All the haters, all the doubters, go fuck yourself.
That's going to do it for us tonight. My name is Paul McGinty.
Ian Sharpley.
Matt Cassell.
And in honor of Stan Lee tonight, I say Excelsior!
Bamf.
No prize.